Thank you, Everett. That was very nicely done. Beautiful piece of music. Very emotional piece of music, and I thought it really came through in the way that you performed it. Thank you very much for that. Nice to have such talent in our congregation. Speaking of talent, I forgot to mention that we will be having this evening the Family Fun Show after the coin roll. So we have services, dinner, coin roll, and then the fun show. So we have a packed and solid afternoon and evening of activities and entertainment for you. The Family Fun Show, for those of you who are watching on the webcast, we do plan to webcast that as well. And who knows, maybe it'll get picked up by one of the networks, you know. But we will be doing our local webcast, and of course we'll tune out after the service is over, and the Family Fun Show should begin at about 7:30. So you can turn us back on if you'd like to see the fun show this evening. And there also will be a video recording. I know that some are listening over the telephone or not able to catch the webcast, so they've asked about the possibility of a video of the Family Fun Show so they can enjoy it later. And so we'll have that available as well. I should mention as well that we'll have to move out after the Family Fun Show fairly quickly. We're kind of pushing the edge, actually beyond the edge of the time that we have actually formally reserved this room. There's nobody coming in after us, so that's not a problem. But we do want to honor the time as closely as we can to what we had scheduled and paid for. The folks here have been really, really nice to us, very accommodating. And so we don't want to... Well, we'll take advantage, but not too much. And we'll want to be respectful of the use of their hall. What would you say are your three best habits? Give some thought to that. What would you say are the most important, the most useful, the best habits that you have established in your life? Or what new habit would you like to develop or change? There are things that we'd like to do that we haven't really fully mastered yet, or habits that we'd like to develop and make part of our lives. And of course, there's another aspect of it as well, another question: what are your bad habits? Don't answer out loud. What are the things that you are aware of that you need to change or that you would like to change? You know, every year, the 1st of January, people make these resolutions and they identify these enormous goals they have in their lives and how much they're going to change. It's the one day of the year that everybody loses weight and stops smoking. And it lasts until January 2nd or 3rd. But they identify these habits and others that they really would like to break. For that matter, right now we're into a season of the year called Lent when people are giving up things that they're accustomed to in some form of penance or, I guess, an attempt at repentance. But they're habits that they have, things that they are going to set aside for a period of time. Habits are very much a part of all of our lives. There's a well-known quote. I've heard variations of this, and I've heard it attributed to a number of different individuals. But it goes like this. This is the version of it I have here. It says, watch your thoughts, for they become words. Watch your words, for they become actions. Watch your actions, for they become habits. Watch your habits, for they become character. Watch your character, for it becomes your destiny. So we have in the middle of this sequence, and I think there's some truth to that sense of the development of habits and character in our lives. Right in the middle of it is this item called our habits. It's part of the development of our character that takes place over a period of time. Habits are the result of a sequence of decisions and actions that are repeated. And so we do something a number of times. Sometimes we can learn something quickly. Other times we have to work harder. But eventually certain patterns become habits in our lives. And habits certainly can help to establish our character. Benjamin Franklin put it this way. He said, "Your net worth to the world is usually determined by what remains after your bad habits are subtracted from your good ones." So you can reduce your character to a mathematical or arithmetic formula. Bad habits, or good habits, I should say, minus bad habits equals character. What's left over after you deduct the bad ones. What we do certainly becomes habitual, and that does establish our character. And of course, we recognize the need to have godly character in order to be part of God's kingdom. So habits are really central to our personal Christian development. The title of the sermon this afternoon is The Habitual Christian. It's a form of mind control, as Mr. Ball was talking about in the sermonette. Controlling our thoughts, which lead to our actions, which become our habits. The dictionary definition of a habit, and this is kind of a combination of three different dictionaries. A habit is a regularly repeated behavior pattern. It's a pattern of behavior that we do repeatedly. Or it's an acquired behavior pattern, regularly followed until it becomes almost involuntary. That's one of the tricky things about habits, is that they become virtually involuntary, just automatic. Or it's something that a person does often in a regular and repeated way. There's a more technical definition of habit from a book I read called The Power of Habit. And that is, a habit is the choices that all of us deliberately make at some point and then stop thinking but continue doing often every day. So it's a pattern where we initially have to think about doing it and we learn to do it. But then once we have learned, then we don't really think about it anymore. We just do it. Mr. Ball was talking about these crazy people who mess with cockroaches. Probably social scientists. They're an odd group. Typically, besides cockroaches, they'd like to mess with rats. And in one experiment recently, they measured the brain activity as rats were learning to how to make their way through a maze. So they'd hook these electrodes up to their heads and they'd measure the brain activity of the rat as it was learning. Now, when the rat successfully maneuvered its way through the maze, it found a reward of a little piece of chocolate. I think most of us would find our way through a maze if we thought there was a Hershey bar at the other end. But the rats caught on fairly quickly. And the path to the chocolate became habitual for the rat. They left the chocolate in the same place in the maze. And what they did, I think we would probably be able to guess this, but the rat's brain activity was pretty strong or pretty high as they were learning the maze and trying to figure out where their reward was. But once they had that figured out, then they didn't think. The brain waves went way down, much lower level, and they just ran through the maze and got their piece of candy. Because they'd learned, and now they didn't have to learn anymore. Now it was a habit. It didn't require any thought or learning. So then these nasty social scientists moved the chocolate to another place in the maze. And guess what? The same thing happened. The rats learned where it was, quite a bit of brain activity involved, and then once they figured it out, they didn't have to think about it so much. So scientists have concluded that our brains convert a sequence of actions which at some point we have to consciously learn and practice. But our brain can turn that into an automatic routine so that we aren't thinking much at all. They call this chunking. A chunk of activities that we've learned becomes a sequence that is automatically used to when certain cues or stimulus are provided. So a conclusion, obviously, is that habitual behavior does not require a great deal of thought process because it's something we've already learned and don't have to continue to learn. What that means is that it's very possible that much of our time each day is spent doing things that really are by habit and not by thought. In fact, a 2006 study published by Duke University concluded that 40% of the actions that people perform each day were not really decisions, but habits. 40% of the things that we do each day, according to this one study, may well be done by habit and not really by conscious thought or choice. Learning a habit is pretty simple and pretty easy. There's a three-step process involved in developing a habit. First of all, there has to be a cue, something that happens that triggers and sets in motion some kind of a behavior pattern. So we have a cue. Maybe we'd like some chocolate. So chocolate sounds good. We'd like to have some chocolate. And we know that there's some chocolate at the end of this maze. So secondly, there's a routine or a pattern of behavior that we follow when this cue goes off. It could be something in our mind. It triggers a thought, an appetite, an idea, something that something happens to us that sets this routine into action. And then the final step is a reward. Habits have that three-step sequence. There's a cue that begins the behavior. There's a routine that you've learned. This is chunk of activities or mental gymnastics if you already memorized. You'll have to think through again. And then there's a reward for doing it. And the reward is why people follow their habits, because they enjoy whatever kind of an outcome that they know they're going to have. So this becomes an automatic sequence, something we can do without really thinking about it. We settle into these habits for at least a couple of reasons. First, because they're familiar and not difficult. We know just what to do. We don't have to rethink it. We know what we're going to do when we have this cue. And secondly, because we enjoy the reward or the satisfaction that comes from following that routine. So habits are very much a part of everyone's life. Obviously, not every habit is a bad habit. We have good habits. I'm sure that you have many very good, very positive, very good habits that are part of your life. Probably many of our habits are just neutral. It's just the way we do things. And we don't even think much about it. And maybe we don't have to. I want to focus on the habits that we have that we should think about. We can easily see that there could be a danger in habitual behavior. There is a great deal of potential hazard if what we do is not something that we think about, but just that's a familiar pattern that leads to a result that we can predict and we find some satisfaction in. The title of the sermon is The Habitual Christian. And this afternoon we're going to talk about three principles of habitual Christian living. Three principles that will help us to understand and to manage our habits. Again, it's a form of, as we were talking about in the sermonette, it's a form of controlling our thoughts and making the right kinds of decisions. So what I have for you is three principles of habitual Christian living. The first principle is pretty simple. Practice, practice, practice. We've already made the point that habits are formed through repetitious action, through actions that we repeat. What's important to us in forming the right kinds of habits, of course, is to practice or to repeat the right kinds of actions. Many of our actions and decisions are based on patterns of response that we have learned, that we have practiced, that we have repeated. But they're not always necessarily the best response. We can learn about habits from something called muscle memory. For example, athletes and musicians would be two groups of people who practice patterns over and over and over again until they've trained themselves to follow a pattern that they can do just almost without thinking. They've learned it, but they practice it repeatedly so that it becomes part of what they're doing. Now, that can work for you or against you. I'm sure that Everett spends many hours practicing his music, practicing a particular piece and the nuances of that music. And it takes a lot of concentration and a lot of effort and a lot of repetition to learn music. In fact, it's at a level that most of us would think, wow, how can anybody even do that? How can anybody even remember or read all those notes and then play that beautiful piece of music? But repeated practice can be, again, work either for you or against you. If Everett were to consistently practice a piece of music wrong, which he doesn't do, but if he were to do that, then he'd be really good at playing that piece badly. He would learn the wrong music. He wouldn't come across, it wouldn't be correct. Same principle is true in athletics or in sports. I would have done well, as Everett did, to learn to play the piano when I was a young guy, but I didn't. I went the basketball route. I decided I was going to be a basketball player, and for maybe a few weeks I was. But I loved basketball. It was the first team sport that I learned. I was about 9 years old when I joined a youth team at a community club or facility, and I was taught some of the basics of basketball. Our coach spent hours, day after day, week after week, drilling into us fundamentals. And even at 9, 10 years of age, we got sick of practicing fundamentals. We just were learning the skills, but we went through all these drills over and over and over and over to learn how to pass, how to dribble, how to shoot, how to position ourselves. After a while, again, it became kind of boring, but the coach warned us. And I don't know how many of us really were able to grasp this, but it's a principle of learning a game or learning a sport that we needed to take practice seriously, because he said when you're in the game, you're going to revert to whatever you practiced. So some of us guys would be out here wildly throwing up these 30-foot shots, you know, and we want to make the big half-court or three-point shot, but that's not the way that you learn the game. If you repeatedly practice bad habits, then you'll be really, really good at playing basketball badly. So there's this idea of muscle memory. You teach your body or your mind the patterns that you need to repeat. An obvious analogy is spiritual muscle memory. If we repeatedly practice Christian fundamentals, then we build the right kinds of habits into our lives. Basketball is not a complicated game at its core. It's about passing, dribbling, shooting, running, and taking a defensive stance. It's pretty simple. Four or five basic fundamentals is what it comes down to learn how to play basketball. Now, they can't teach you athleticism, That's where the coach let me down. Fundamentals, I can learn, I can see somebody else doing it, but that doesn't mean I can do it. But the basics of basketball are not that complicated. Neither is Christianity. Christianity is not that complicated. God's law is not a complicated thing, but the challenge of it is to repeat the obedience consistently, constantly, until over time it becomes ingrained into our minds and the right kind of a habit. Now, habits can be mindless, just reactions. That's not what we're talking about. Christianity is never a mindless reaction. We'll have to make decisions and choices, but we repeat those, and as we do so, it becomes ingrained into our character. Hebrews chapter 5, verse 12. Hebrews, the 5th chapter. Verse 12. You see, as you learn, you become skilled enough at something that you can be one who can help teach it as well. That's the point that's being given here. It says, by this time you ought to be teachers, but you need someone to teach you again the first principles of the oracles of God. You've come to need milk and not solid food. In other words, this was being addressed to people who had needed to go back to those fundamentals because they hadn't really ingrained them deeply enough into their habits and into their character. Drop to verse 14, solid food, in other words, mature spiritual knowledge, belongs to those who are of full age and to those who by reason of use have exercised their senses to discern both good and evil. Those who by reason of use or reason of practice have exercised or trained their minds to discern good and evil. It's that spiritual muscle memory that we can build into our thought process. How do we do it? By being trained or by being exercised, by developing those skills through constant practice. Now, one way to develop one way to break a bad habit is to replace it with a good habit. So I think we can easily see that there are things in our lives that we would recognize we should do differently. And the way to change that is to replace it with the right kind of repetition, the right kind of activity. Interesting. You know that if you happen to own a smartphone, there are thousands and thousands of apps out there, and you often hear the phrase "there's an app for that." Well, there's an app to help you build good habits. It's kind of a mechanical thing. It's kind of a superficial thing, but you can go on iTunes if you'd like, and you'll find, or go to the iStore, and you'll find lots of apps that are designed to help you build good habits. What they do is they give you a way to record the things you want to do and then keep track of how often you do it. And they give you a little chart, a little calendar. You can indicate on the calendar how many days you've lived up to this new pattern you're trying to develop in your life, and it'll keep score for you. It'll help you identify how many days in a row you've practiced this new good habit that you're trying to form. Do the same thing with a piece of paper and a pencil, but people like to do things with smartphones that seem like they're clever. But the point is that we learn the right way by repeating it over and over, to exercise, to build up that spiritual muscle memory. Paul, in 1 Timothy chapter 4, compares this physical activity to the spiritual memory or muscles. 1 Timothy chapter 4. Begin verse 7. We'll start a couple of the sentences back here and work our way up to the point he's making. He writes to Timothy that Timothy should reject profane and old wives' fables and exercise yourself toward godliness. Exercise, train, practice, repeat, focus on the fundamentals. Exercise yourself toward godliness. There are a lot of things out there that we could be distracted by. There's something called the shiny object syndrome. You know, whatever catches someone's attention sometimes will draw them away and break their focus or their concentration. Paul says to Timothy, look, recognize what's not helpful and meaningful. Reject wives' fables and profane teachings. And practice, exercise, learn the habit of godliness. For bodily exercise profits a little. Physical muscle memory, nothing wrong with that. Some of you are runners. Some of you exercise maybe with weights or have other kinds of exercise routines. A lot of you probably dance and do aerobic type exercises. Those kinds of things are profitable to a certain extent. Not wrong to do those things. It profits a little, but godliness is profitable for all things. Spiritual muscle memory is more important than the physical. And we can't overlook the need to be physically healthy, but godliness, by comparison, is what is most important. It's profitable for all things, having promise of the life that now is and of that which is to come. See, physical fitness or physical muscle memory will help you now. Certainly it will. And again, there's nothing that's wrong with that. But spiritual muscle memory, spiritual habits, what we learn through spiritual workouts and exercise goes not only to help us in this life, but also in the life that is to come. It directs us to that eternal promise that God holds out for us. So, developing the right kinds of habits is a matter of focus and a matter of practice. It's a matter of not just going through a day or through a period of time, just reacting and responding and living only by memory or by habit, but by taking charge of those thoughts and in some cases changing the pattern so that we are being exercised spiritually, exercised to godliness. Now, Peter writes of another extreme, something that we need to be certainly aware of. 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 14. See, here's the kind of a warning. 2 Peter is largely about false teachers, those who intentionally try to confuse and mislead God's people, and it's a pretty strong condemnation of those who are false teachers. And that's the general subject here. We pick it up in chapter 2, verse 14. These people feast with you. They have their eyes full of adultery and cannot cease from sin, enticing unstable souls. They have a heart trained in covetous practices. This is the other side of the coin. I'm not suggesting that it describes any of us, but I show it or suggest it as the other side. We can train our lives, as Paul wrote about to Timothy, in godliness. That's what we should do. But by the same token, if we practice evil, then that will become what we're skilled at. That will become part of our habitual way of living. That will become part of our character. So the contrast is shown here between the two. Again, I'm not saying that we are that way, but I'm saying that the potential is there for anyone. Anyone who practices sinful or evil patterns will ingrain those into their hearts. They will become habits and eventually their character. So the concept of spiritual muscle memory, thinking of it, understanding something about it, can itself become kind of an underlying habit. We can check ourselves. We can consider whether the decisions we're making, we can make this part of our thought process. Are the decisions we're making, the way that we're living, the way that we're responding, a matter of habit? Or are they a matter of conscious, and careful, reasoned choice? Remember that when a habit emerges, the brain stops fully participating. When we do something just by habit, we're not really thinking it through anymore. Now, Christianity is not something that we should ever practice without giving thought to it. I'm not saying that Christianity becomes a habit itself that we don't have to think about anymore. What I'm suggesting is that we can challenge our habits in the way that we reach our decisions or what our behavior is based upon. And when we find that it's necessary, we can replace that with a new and a better habit. Modify what we're doing. Unless we do catch ourselves and deliberately think about what we're doing, then we may continue in the automatic patterns, which are not thoughtful and careful choices. So the first principle, then, that we're discussing here this afternoon is to practice. Practice that spiritual muscle development. Develop spiritual muscle memory so that when we do react to a situation, it's based on that proper and reasoned kind of behavior that is meaningful or proper for a Christian. The second principle that we'll talk about today in terms of developing these habits in our lives that are proper and meaningful and helpful to us, the second principle is walk worthy of the Lord. Walk worthy of the Lord. Paul uses that phrase in Colossians chapter 1, verse 10. Colossians chapter 1, the phrases in verse 10, we'll start reading in verse 9 to lead up to it. This is still part of the introduction of Paul's book, or his letter, I should say, to the Colossians. He's talking about his concern and care for them. He says in verse 9 of chapter 1, "For this reason, we also, since the day we heard it, do not cease to pray for you and to ask that you may be filled with the knowledge of his will in all wisdom and spiritual understanding." Verse 10, "that you may walk worthy of the Lord, fully pleasing him, being fruitful in every good work." Walking is a familiar metaphor in Scripture. Walking represents how we conduct ourselves, how we live. The path of life that we follow is the one that we walk. It has to do with our choices. It has to do with our habits. It has to do with how we live from one day to the next. Most of our walking, most of our life really is pretty ordinary. Pretty much a daily set of sometimes, you know, there's a sudden change or a challenge. But for the most part, our lives have a fairly predictable path. And we walk that path. And Paul says that we should walk worthy of the Lord. The word worthy kind of tricks us up sometimes. The worthy does not mean that something that we deserve or earn. Talk about, for example, the phrase we use sometimes is whether a person is worth his salt. Is he a worthwhile person? Does he deserve? Does he earn? His salary or his what people are looking for? Have they earned it? To walk worthy of the Lord does not mean to earn anything or to be deserving. The Greek word that's used here, word worthy, means to be appropriate or fitting. Paul is urging that we live our lives in a way that is appropriate, in a way that properly represents Jesus Christ. It says in Ephesians chapter 4, I'm not going to turn to this one, a very similar phrase, Ephesians 4 verse 1, Paul writes, "Walk worthy of the calling with which you were called." That we walk in a way, that we live in a way, that our life reflects appropriately the one who we've named ourselves after. We call upon the name of the Messiah, that we are his disciples. We call ourselves Christians. Christ meaning Messiah. We're followers. We're disciples of Jesus Christ. And so Paul's point is that our lives then must reflect that that's who we represent, that we truly represent our Messiah by the way that we live. In other words, again, the patterns of our lives. Do we properly represent Jesus Christ in that way? We could ask ourselves, we can evaluate ourselves this way. Is this the person that I want to be? Now, certain times that might be answered in different ways, depending on where we find ourselves. Is the way I live really the person that I want to be? Is this the person that God wants me to be? God went to quite a length to provide a Messiah for us. And he's called us and given us an understanding of Jesus Christ. He's called us into a way of life because of Jesus and the sacrifice he made for us. Can we say that God is probably satisfied with that investment that he's made? When he looks at our lives, is that what he meant? Is that what he intended? Are we walking the way that represents our Savior and represents our calling? Those are pretty serious questions, and often they're answered by our habits, the way that we live from day to day, the patterns of life that we've learned and that we practice. Are we living up to the calling that God has given to us? Living up to the name of our Savior, after whom we are called. Now, that's a pretty serious set of questions, but it's one that's important for us to consider. And I think, obviously, we're heading into a time of year when those kind of questions really become more of our focus as we examine ourselves. Am I walking worthy? Is my daily routine, my habitual behavior, my patterns of life, do they represent the one who gave his life for me so that I could have these opportunities? A lot of times people will make a comment something like this. Well, if that's the way a Christian behaves, and they judge us sometimes, we claim certain things, but do we live up to it? Would we be vulnerable to that kind of comment? Now, usually that's an unfair criticism and judgment made by people who themselves are very cynical and not really thinking properly about other people's behavior. But is that the way a Christian behaves? Do we represent Jesus Christ in our lives? Only we can answer that question for ourselves. Again, we ask ourselves, are my habits, and my pattern of life those of a Christian? There are a lot of different habits we might consider that would be good ones, and I'm not going to get real specific about that. I found a list, though, that I found that was interesting. In 1726, at the age of 20, Benjamin Franklin created a system to develop his own character. He decided he wanted to evaluate himself and be sure that he had the kind of character that he expected of himself. And in his autobiography, in fact, in an essay in addition to that, but later in his autobiography, Franklin listed 13 virtues. A virtue is a positive element of character or moral strength. I think we could also consider them to be habits. It's the way that a person behaves. It's the pattern that he follows. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time, but I'll list these 13 elements of virtue or of habits that Benjamin Franklin came up with. And again, keep in mind, when he developed this list, he was 20 years old. Look at the things that he wrote. Okay, 13 of them here. First of all, temperance. Temperance is a kind of self-control. And here's what he said about temperance. He said, "Eat not to dullness, drink not to elevation." Okay? In other words, be controlled in the way that you satisfy your appetites. Second virtue or habit is silence. "Speak not but what may benefit others or yourself. Avoid trifling conversation." You know, as you look at each of these elements, you can put some scriptures there with it. James says to be quick to hear and slow to speak and slow to anger. Jesus said that what comes out of our heart reflects, out of our mouth reflects what's in our heart. Paul told Timothy not to be involved in trivial conversations. So one of the virtues or habits that Franklin identifies is silence. Third, order. "Let all your things have their places. Let each part of your business have its time." Order or organization or structure. Number four is resolution. "Resolve to perform what you ought and perform without fail what you resolve." Pretty inclusive statement. Perform what you ought, and without fail, perform what you resolve. Number five is frugality. "Make no expense but to do good to others or yourself. Waste nothing." Frugality is not a pattern of living that our society today is known for. But it certainly is a real strength of character and the kind of habit we should all have. Sixth in his list is industry. Now, of course, remember he wrote this in 1726, so some of the wording is a little bit different than our language today. But number six was industry. Let's talk about effort. "Lose no time. Be always employed in something useful. Cut off all unnecessary actions." Pretty sound advice about having the right kind of energy and focus in our lives. Number seven, sincerity. "Use no hurtful deceit. Think innocently and justly. And if you speak, speak accordingly." Be careful what we say, but when we do, be sincere, be innocent, and be just. His eighth virtue or habit is justice. "Wrong none by doing injuries or omitting the benefits that are your duty." Pretty basic, just, you know, general, do what's right and don't hurt others. Number nine, moderation. "Avoid extremes. Forbear resenting injuries." In other words, be careful not to injure others. Number 10, cleanliness. A pretty good habit, pretty good strength or quality of moral moral behavior. Number 10, cleanliness. Tolerate no uncleanness in body, clothes, or habitation. Pretty big words for a bachelor at the age of 20. Number 11, tranquility. Be not disturbed at trifles or at accidents common or unavoidable. You know, don't be too easily shaken up. Don't be hysterical. Number 12, this is interesting, would be an interesting concept for our society today. Number 12 is chastity. He says, rarely use venery, but for, well, you said, what's venery? Venery is a 1720s word for meaning sexual pleasure. Rarely use venery, but for health or offspring, never to dullness, weakness, or the injury of your own or another's peace or reputation. That would go over really well at a university today, wouldn't it? But it's a moral quality, it's a virtue, and it's a kind of habit that we can build into our lives to live a moral and clean life. Number 13, the last on his list, is humility. And he says, imitate Jesus and Socrates. Now, I don't know that I fully endorse Socrates, but obviously imitate Jesus. 13 pretty basic, solid moral qualities and habitual patterns that we can build into our lives. Benjamin Franklin arrived at these concepts through human reasoning. Like many of our founding fathers, quote-unquote, Franklin had a strong moral foundation. Now, we wouldn't necessarily consider him Christian by our standards, but he had a strong moral foundation, and he had a center on God and on the fact that there is a higher power that we answer to. So, again, I wouldn't say that he was a Christian person in the sense that we might define that word. But that strong moral foundation and a realization that there is law, there is spiritual law, there is a foundation that establishes the way that we should conduct ourselves. Benjamin Franklin had that core. In today's society, we simply don't. There's certainly nothing improper about any of those values or virtues that he listed. It may help us to see some of the ways that we can and do, we are, practicing and walking in a way that would please and honor God and Jesus Christ. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 9. By the way, if you wanted to, you could take any of those 13 qualities that Benjamin Franklin identified, and you can there are scriptures that would help to support the importance of those qualities. I would say that the Bible is what establishes what Franklin taught, not that we establish the Bible by what he said, but the Bible reinforces those principles that he identified. 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 9. Concerning brotherly love, you have no need that I should write to you, for you yourselves are taught by God to love one another. There's a good habit to pick up on. Verse 10, and indeed you do so toward all the brethren who are in Macedonia. This was a special offering and that he was taking up on behalf of their brethren who were in need. But we urge you, brethren, that you increase more and more, that you aspire to lead a quiet life, to mind your own business, to work with your hands, and as we commanded you, that you may walk properly toward those who are outside. Paul here is urging, again, in different words, but the same principle. He's urging the basic patterns or habits of a Christian life. Again, from day to day, what we typically practice And we do practice what we've learned. We practice what we have, or we perform what we have practiced. We have any number of different habits in our lives. Do we respond in a way that shows that we have control and that we are exercising good habits? How do you respond to annoying people? How do you treat your spouse and children? Not saying that they're annoying. How do we prepare for and enter into the Sabbath? How do we relax? What kind of entertainment do we enjoy? Where do we go, mentally or literally, when we need some downtime or some relaxing time? How do we budget our time? See, these are all habits and practices, things that we do every day. What kind of a character do they reflect? Where does prayer and Bible study fit into our day? There are 1,001 decisions that we make every day about how we're going to live, what we're going to do. As we exercise ourselves to make the right choices, we're building the right patterns. We're learning to walk according to our calling, to walk worthy of the Lord. Let's consider one other aspect of our habits. The third principle to keep in mind is that other people's habits affect your habits. Other people's habits affect your habits. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 32. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 32. I'm going to again read here, leading into the statement we want to get to, which is in the next verse. But he says in verse 32, In all manner of men I fought with beasts at Ephesus. What advantage was that to me? He's talking about the experiences that he's had in his ministry. If the dead do not rise, in other words, for what I've gone through, what difference does it make if there's no resurrection? That's what this whole chapter is about. He was challenged, you can see at the beginning of the chapter, that some didn't believe in the resurrection or didn't believe that Jesus Christ was resurrected. And so this whole chapter is not only a defense of, but an explanation about the resurrection. So he says, look, why did I bother to go through all these things that I've experienced if there's no resurrection? If the dead do not rise, let us eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Do not be deceived. Evil company corrupts good habits. Awake to righteousness and do not sin. What did Paul mean by this statement here? It kind of almost seems out of context or out of place. Evil company corrupts good habits. Paul is urging here the basic patterns. He's urging us to have a better understanding. The statement, evil company corrupts good habits, was a well-known statement or quote. Paul is quoting a Greek poet named Menander. Menander, again, was a poet. He wrote a lot of plays. He was kind of a performer. The Greeks loved to listen to philosophers philosophize. And so he would do lectures, and he'd written a number of different things that the people of Corinth, being in Greece, were familiar with. So Paul is appealing to the Greek members of the church by quoting someone that they know, someone that they knew very well. Again, remember that the entire chapter is about the truth of the resurrection. Paul's concern was that church members might be influenced by false teachings about the resurrection. So he's warning them to be careful who they listen to, who they allow to influence their thoughts. That evil company corrupts good habits. In this case, the evil company would be those who were teaching false things about the resurrection. So Paul says, watch out for that. And he quotes a person that they were familiar with, a very familiar quote to them, that evil company will corrupt good habits. So, again, back up to verse 32, which we read. He says, if I die, if what I've gone through, if there's no resurrection, then why would I bother to go through what I've done? Let us eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. The point here is that, again, if there's no resurrection, if there's no final judgment for how we live, then what is there to worry about? Who cares what we do? Just have a good time. Do all you can to enjoy yourself. You don't need to go to all the trouble of developing godly habits. Just eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Now, that is a quote from Isaiah 22, verse 13. And I won't go back and read it. You can read verses 12 and 13 in Isaiah 22. What you find there is that the people of Judah were mocking the prophets. The prophets were warning them that they were going to be punished as a nation because of their sins. They were rejecting the prophets, rejecting the message. They didn't really believe they were going to die. They didn't really believe that they were going to be punished in the way that they were being told. So they were making fun of the warning. And they continued in their practice of their sinful ways. And so their sarcastic response, their mocking response to Jeremiah or to Isaiah was, well, let's eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And so Paul, in this statement then, in verse 32, is quoting from the Old Testament. And this would appeal to the Jewish members of the congregation. So in these two verses, he's used quotes that were known to both of these groups of people. Both the Jews, who would recognize the context and the meaning of that statement, and the Gentiles, or the Greeks, who would understand the quote from Menander. Paul's point is simple. If faithful members associate with unfaithful people, it could affect their habits. It could erode their confidence, their understanding. He's agreeing with the Greek writer, the Greek man that he's quoting, that evil company corrupts good habits. So Paul's point is that if we're going to maintain good habits, we need to be careful who we listen to. We need to be careful that we're learning the truth from a truthful source. Not to be sarcastic about what God has warned, and not to allow ourselves or to be associated with those who are teaching wrong values or something that's not truthful. He says that in the context here of wrong teachings or false teachings about the resurrection. So that's the principle. The application of it for us would be that we simply need to choose our friends carefully. We need to choose our friends to be those who will be a positive influence in our lives. Because they do affect our thinking and our behavior. They do affect our habits. The kind of people that we are will be affected by. Now, some think, well, I can be a good example to these others, these scoundrels. Well, you probably can. But at the same time, if you're setting yourself up by allowing them to influence you, then you are putting in danger, in jeopardy, your own good habits. So we need to choose our friends carefully. And secondly, we need to be the kind of friend that others need. We need to be the kind of friend who is a good example and a good and positive influence on others. People do affect us, and sometimes in a negative way. A British writer named Somerset Maugham, a British writer, made this statement. He said, an unfortunate thing about this world is that the good habits are much easier to give up than the bad ones. We are affected by the company we keep. That would include by the entertainment that we choose, But whatever we allow to influence our minds, our thoughts, do have an effect on us. And it's not hard to let go of a good habit, but it can be very difficult to give up a bad habit. Now, to illustrate this point just a little further, maybe illustrate the other side of the coin about avoiding those who are bad influence. There was an interesting study by a group called the Alcohol Research Group. And they did a study about why it is that an organization like Alcoholics Anonymous is able to help people overcome the terribly destructive habit of alcoholism. It's more than a habit, it's an addiction, but we're using some terms in a very general way here. But how does AA help people overcome alcoholism? Here's a quote from one of the researchers named Leanne Kaskatis. She says, "There's something really powerful about groups and shared experiences. People might be skeptical about their ability to change if they're by themselves, but a group will help them to suspend disbelief. A community creates belief." What does that mean to us? See, that's one of the reasons why God has gathered us together as a family. Because we provide that support for one another. We're not the bad influence that hurts someone else's character or habits, but we're a good, strong influence. We need one another. God has gathered us together so that we can interact with each other in a positive way to help strengthen one another in our efforts. And we do that, don't we? We're always encouraged when we have an opportunity to be together on the Sabbath. We're encouraged when we talk to each other and we share our experiences and we see what others are going through, what they're enduring, how they're holding up. And it strengthens us to continue as well. We need one another. We need to be that influence, that positive influence to affect other people's habits. We can't live anybody else's life or make anyone's decision for them, but we certainly can give them encouragement. And we do strengthen one another by our examples and by our friendship, by our support. We've all had that experience. It's in a very personal note. I've certainly had that very recently. The sense of concern and of support and of care that we show for each other is very encouraging, very inspiring. And it strengthens us. It reinforces our own efforts to have that right pattern of life, those right qualities of character and the habits that we need to develop. Being together, you know, a couple of verses in Hebrews, I'm sure you thought of Hebrews 3, verse 12. Hebrews 3, verse 12. Other people's habits affect your habits. Other people's positive influence and example means a great deal to every one of us. Hebrews 3, verse 12. "Beware, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God." See, that's just what this researcher was writing about. That by nature, sometimes we don't have confidence. We don't have faith. We don't have the commitment by ourselves. "But exhort one another daily while it is called today." We can encourage and strengthen one another because we are that family. And it does inspire a healthier approach and mindset within each one of us. Chapter 10, verse 24. Hebrews 10, verse 24. "Let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works." To stir one another up to those good, healthy, positive habits and patterns of service and of care for one another. To help to inspire and in a right way to develop or to give the energy and the encouragement to develop, to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some, but exhorting one another, so much the more as you see the day approaching. Familiar verses, and again, we can see how much they are helpful to us so that we recognize the positive influence we can have on one another. So the point that Paul is making in 1 Corinthians 15 goes well with this point in Hebrews, that we should avoid those who are going to erode our resolve, that would challenge or threaten the good habits we have in our lives, and we need to work together as a family, a church family, to practice those right patterns and to encourage them in one another. Stephen Covey, probably a pretty well-known writer, he wrote a book called The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. Many of you have read that book. One statement from his writing, he says, "Our character is basically a composite of our habits. Because they are consistent, often unconscious patterns, they constantly, daily express our character." One thing that's consistent in our lives would be our habits. The way that we respond, things we've learned, they're not always conscious patterns. We should be sure that we don't let life become an unconscious series of reactions and patterns. But we do constantly express who we are by the way that we do pattern our lives, that we should constantly express, be working toward that godly character. Christianity is the way we live. It's who we are. It's what we aspire to. It's what our goal is. It's what we practice. It's something we can give careful thought to. Especially, as I've mentioned, as we approach the Passover and the days of unleavened bread. It's a time of introspection. And one way that we can examine ourselves is to consider our habits. Christianity should never be a matter of routine, of thoughtless, automatic behavior, as some habits may be. But we should be habitual Christians, constantly and thoughtfully choosing our patterns of behavior based on the laws of God, so that our habits become a means by which we are developing the character and the mind of God.